Our world is magical. Games are magical. Open your eyes and prepare to discover how magic and games intersect.
Merry meet and welcome to Covenstead, a podcast about gaming and magic.
This episode is brought to you by Kaboom.com. That's right, Kaboom.com, minus five O's, no apologies, where they review, rant, and rave about comics, movies, television, and all they inspire. They're just like us, except they have a website.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Covenstead, where we talk about gaming and magic and other things. And I am Danny, and I am here with my coven mate, co-conspirator, partner in crime, Todd.
Hello, hello, hello. That is right. We're here. We're back. And we're going to talk about, well, actually, Danny, you're the one doing the intro. Look at me chiming in. What is it we're going to be talking about today?
We're going to be talking about competency today. Expectations around it. I mean, and, you know, different genres and different jobs of gaming, GM and player and competency and all of those sorts of things. You'll get the idea once we start talking. It may sound like competency. What does that mean?
Yeah.
But Todd brought it up, and I think it'll be good for us to talk about and could lead to a lot of different topics in the future when we start talking about this. So why don't you start off, Todd? You seem to have some ideas and had talked with your friends about this already. So
why don't you go ahead
and get started about what you're talking about.
Yeah, I did a little research on this one because it initially when I started coming up with this as a topic, it kind of seemed like a, you know, how far could we really go with this? Or am I just kind of blowing smoke up my butt? And I'm not just saying that because I live in a wildfire zone at the moment. smoke in the lungs. But yeah, it's when I started thinking about, maybe I should go back on this a little bit. So as I've mentioned in the last couple of episodes, I'm working on a new version of my Assassin RPG Killshot, and the idea behind it was to take the system behind Pandora Total Destruction and use it to for this new edition of Killshot. Right away, the biggest issue that I found between the two games is the sense that in Pandora, you start off as somebody who does not have any or has very little control over a very destructive power. And over the course of play, you develop better control. It's not always perfect, but it gets better. The idea being that you learn how to control something that would otherwise be uncontrollable. And it's different with what I needed to do with Killshot, where you need to start off as having somebody who is somewhat competent and capable at committing a particular type of crime, who becomes part of a crew. And each of them have their own specialties and that kind of stuff. And that forced me to change some things mechanically. But then it kind of got me thinking as part of like how much of a key component that can or even cannot be in a game. So for me, I'm kind of looking at this from a game design standpoint. Go figure. Surprise, surprise. And it really got me thinking about the fact of just how people's expectation of their characters' capabilities from the beginning, from like level one, so to speak, can really be a factor in play. So I want to ask you a question, mm-hmm. Danny. When you go to start playing something, your expectation of what your characters are supposed to be able to do, do you like having a character who is very capable at doing a few things, or is very well-rounded, kind of like a jack-of-all-trades, where they're capable of doing a bunch of things? Maybe not the greatest, but they're better than the average person at, you know, a bunch of different things. Like, what's kind of your preference walking in?
I generally tend to pick somebody who's good at one or two things. I always feel like then it becomes clear in play, like, when my character's supposed to shine, you know? Like if I make my character something specific, who does something specific, It's really easy then to kind of throw spotlight when the opportunity arrives, and I'll pick something that I want to interact with in the game. Like, for instance, we're playing Werewolf, or we're going to be playing Werewolf very soon. And we've been playing for a couple seasons now. My group does stuff in seasons. I've talked about that before. So if you want to go back to GMing styles, and when we've talked about that, you can hear how my group sets up in seasons. But we've done a couple seasons of Werewolf now. And my character, Aster, I made him very aware of the Umbra and spiritual stuff, because that's the sort of stuff I wanted to play with in Werewolf. So he has a lot of spiritual umbral ability in the game. I mean, he's gotten over time, over a couple seasons, he's gotten more skills, but he started out with having some capability. His parents were both Thaurges. And if you don't know Werewolf the Apocalypse, I'm going back to the 90s, like Werewolf World of Darkness stuff. But, you know, werewolves in Garou in Werewolf, you know, they're born under different moons, and the different moons have different abilities, right? And so, or different, you know, roles within werewolf society, Garou society. And Thaurges are the spiritual leaders. They're the ones that deal with the Umbra and all the spiritual stuff. So I made him a Thaurge, born under a Thaurge, you know, that moon. And then I also made him an Actena, which is also a tribe of Garou that is very well known for spiritual stuff. So I kind of set him up to have all of that, and his backstory had all of that. I also made him a Metis, who are also in some tribes known to be very spiritual as well. So I tried to set him up as that, so that whenever that sort of thing came up and we had to go into the Umbra, you know, it was kind of his realm of getting everybody through that, because he kind of knew what to do via his parents, who were also of that, you know, were spiritual as well. So he had learned from his parents, and who died tragically, because I'm a player. So of course I made a tragic backstory for him. But yeah, so I tend to like something where I kind of start out, even if he's not as good as he's gonna be in the beginning, at the start of Werewolf, and he's gotten way more powerful over the seasons, and the more he's interacted and all of that stuff. He at least started out with having a very good idea of what he's going to be good at, you know, what he's going to be good at, you know? Yeah. So I generally prefer to kind of set my characters up with an idea in mind of what their milieu is going to be, and try to do as much as I can to try to get them to fit in that milieu. It doesn't have to mean personality either, because a lot of people tend to think of, you know, spiritual, he's very zen, he's very calm. Aster is not. He's much more like Constantine. He is not happy about any of this stuff going on, and he has no time for spiritual bullshit.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just like, look, you know, this is what's happening. My partner, my Nathan, my husband, who runs the game. Well, one time they found this dagger that was a fetish, which has a spirit inside of it, basically. Mm-hmm. And so they pick it up, and Aster dealt with it because it was a spirit. So he's talking to the spirit, and the spirit starts going on about who he was, like, do you know who I am? I'm the Scourge of blah, 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 blah. And Aster was just like, look, do you want to kill shit or not?
Yeah.
Like, he just does not have time for spirits playing around. So, you know, but long answer to your question on a rant talking about my character, but the short answer is I generally prefer to have something that they're good at rather than like a jack of all trades.
Yeah. Okay.
In the end.
So like a spotlight specialties, do you like that character to be able to shine at particular moments when the adventure calls for it and everything like that? So, yeah, which is, how pretty much most games are built. They're built in a form of every character is good at something, and it's a matter of all the all the combinations of everyone at the table are enough to handle the problems that you're about to be presented with, whether it's in a, you know, pre-generated adventure or something that the GM makes up on the fly and all this other kind of stuff. I'm the same, so to speak, but I've also, I don't know, I'm not particularly too fussy with it in the sense where it's just like, you know, if it's a game that, you know, everybody is kind of like a little good at everything, you know, then that'll work for me too. If that's kind of one of those things where we're all set up to be that way, we might have something that gives us a little bit of an edge than others. But it's one of those things where, like, I've very much noticed over the years of just kind of reading different games and, you know, making of my own, that is really interesting that almost every single game that I can think of, except for horror games, has a base level of competency for the characters of what I call 50% plus one. In the sense that if you take an average NPC and give them whatever die mechanic, you know, whatever mechanic actually for that most part, let's not be discriminatory. There's different kinds of ways to determine resolution. But generally, if two NPCs decide that they're both going to walk up and try and smack each other, each one of them has a 50% chance of getting it done. Player characters, for the most part, are built with just an extra little advantage that lets them do a little bit better than your average NPC at the very least. So, for example, if you take D&D's mechanics, the idea is that everything is accomplished by rolling a d20, and if you try and smack someone across the face, you have to do it against their armor class, which defaults to a 10, unless you've got somebody who's anti-dexterous, you know, incredibly clumsy, and so they're, you know, their armor class is worse. But in general, you're actually trying to roll a 10 or higher on a d20. I know I used to make the mistake, and I know a lot of other players made the mistake, that that's 50% chance right there. But it's actually not, because it's, wow, I can't even do basic math at the moment. That's okay. I'll just focus on talking. But you know what? Let me pull. I got a calculator right here. What am I doing? This is also my business desk. Oh, my goodness. There's a math teacher right now who is just curling around in his grave.
I did not know there was going to be math involved in this episode.
Apparently not, because I did not sign up for this. I can't even do the basics. So there's actually 11 numbers on a 20-sided die that will hit with no modifiers to armor class or anything like that. So that's actually 11 divided by 20. There we go. That's what I thought, and it seemed too easy to be that quick. You actually have a 55% chance of striking a nobody with absolutely no skill whatsoever. And that's kind of what I mean by the 50% plus one. It's kind of like you have a little bit more than a 50% advantage, and it depends on the game as to what that is. Then there's ways that the player characters are kind of enhanced to go a little further. And in most cases, that's a form of specialty. I'm a fighter. I'm really good at attacking people with weapons. I'm a spellcaster. I'm far better at actually using magic than I am a melee weapon, et cetera, et cetera. And that right there, yeah, but like I said, but it does appear to be that horror games don't have that. There actually appears to be quite a few horror games where, sure, maybe you're the local sheriff, and so you've got sheriff-based skills and expertise and resources to fall off of, but they ain't gonna do shit for you in this moment, because a lot of horror is based on being in a situation out of your control, out of your milieu, and your specialty, over your head. You're super screwed, and now you have to survive somehow. And
the phrase in Call of Cthulhu that we like to say is Call of Cthulhu, when you play Call of Cthulhu, you're either up dead or incoherent. Those are the two options that you get. Like, no one comes out of it. Like, that's it.
Yeah.
That's all.
Yeah. And I found that part to be fascinating, because I thought, I always just kind of assumed, I've never really played a lot of horror games And it's only recently I started where I'm playing a group online with Knights Black Agents. And that one, I went in with the assumption, because I've always heard it plugged as being Jason Bourne versus vampires. And having now played it, I like to think of it as being more of like the Expendables versus vampires. Because Jason Bourne, he doesn't really get the crap kicked out of him as much. You know, it only happens if it's like narratively important. But really, in an essence, if he was actually statted out on a sheet, he'd be like level 25 from moment one. Like, he's just, you know, like a near untouchable demigod of spies. It really seems to be. Whereas, at least in our game that we've been playing, like, my guy's been getting smacked around a lot. So, but anyways, but it's still that sense of, you know, oh, okay, so we are good at a few things. But because Knight's Black Agent uses the gumshoe system and everything is a resource management, as you use your skills, you spend points and then eventually you run out. And then you're just rolling a die. You're just going with that, once again, 50% plus one chance of succeeding. And that resource management is what has actually created this tension. Like, we ended up walking into a crypt and came across like a vampire thrall. I'm not totally sure what type of creature this was. But she started kicking the shit out of us. and which is how it's supposed to be. And it quickly became down to, it's just like, okay, I happen to have a stick of dynamite. How much am I willing to spend of my explosive skill to survive this encounter when I know we need to use our explosive skills to bring down this building later, you know, and all this other kind of stuff. And I found that to be a really effective way of playing around with my expectations of the game and how competent my character was. Where it's like, I am, but only for a limited time. I'm like a Burger King sandwich. It's only around for a limited time and then it's gone.
Right. Right. Yeah. And I think for horror games, it's different because you have to think about why people play horror games, right? Why do people play horror games? They want to be scared. And what's an easy way to be scared is to feel helpless or powerless or that there isn't, you know what I mean? That is very much, you know, what scares people. You know what I mean? So horror games will often play with that. Into the fact that, yes, you could be some Joe Schmo off the street involved in horror. But more often than not, or in a lot of cases, these people are going to be competent people who are running into things when they're not used to being incompetent. Yeah. They're not used to running up against problems that they can't handle. You know what I mean? Look at The Thing. You know, these guys are scientists, they're living in the Arctic, you know, they're tough people, right? They're not stupid. You know, they're all scientists, they're all tough. I mean, it's Kurt Russell, you know, like, okay.
Yeah.
But then they run into something that makes them scared, that makes them question themselves, that makes them do things, you know what I mean? And that can be scary because a lot of horror movies will show us how competent these people are, how well they do their jobs, and then have them run into something where none of that is going to work or none of that is going to be as helpful as it has been to them in the past. And that makes us go, oh, shit, you know, this is horrifying. They can't do anything. And, you know, especially if you have someone who's bought into their own competence, right? They bought into the fact that I can do these things. I can, you know, I'm smart, I'm capable, I'm on this elite research team, or I am on this super secret mission in outer space, or I am delving deep into these jungles, I do this all the time. You know, they're confident in their abilities, and then they run into something that they don't know how to handle, and that makes it even worse, you know, because some Joe Schmo knows they're a Joe Schmo sometimes, you know, they're like, I can't handle this. I'm just a normal person.
I'm just a pizza delivery guy, you know.
I'm just a pizza delivery guy. And in that case, if you start out that way, more often than not, they find reserves in themselves that they never knew they had, AKA the final girl.
Yeah. 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 Thinking about it now, I find the movie Predator to be far more of a horror movie than an action film, because those are characters where they are highly skilled combatants. You see in the beginning, they basically walk into this village. Nah, it's actually more of a base. And they just wipe the floor with all these other rebel soldiers. You know, like walk away unscathed. I think one guy gets like a scratch on his arm or something like that. Clearly know what they're doing.
I don't got time to bleed.
Yeah, I got time to bleed.
I got time to bleed. But just then, Ventura.
Yeah, but then they meet the Predator and that thing starts picking them off one by one. These guys start shitting their pants. Like the one guy basically, he kind of enters this state of almost like this PTSD he's getting and starts actually like, you know, carving his chest with his own knife and all this other kind of stuff.
Yep.
The one character, you know, starts going mad and, you know, kind of starts like, you know, talking to himself, and everyone's getting really starting to doubt whether or not he should be holding a gun anymore. And that is, it's really neat to, when it's something like that really changes how you think about a particular genre.
No, they even at one point, I mean, to kind of build it up, because Predator is kind of the quintessential of what I'm talking about with, you take these super competent people and put them in a situation where they're over their head and they start freaking out. So you're like, holy shit, I'm freaking out, you know? They even build it up because they find these green berets who have been skinned and hanging in the trees. Yeah. You know, and they're like, these guys were green berets out of Fort Bragg. You know, I don't do an Arnold accent, but Arnold says it. You know, Arnold's like, these guys were green berets out of Fort Bragg. What were they doing here? How did this happen? Yeah. Right? So you know that no matter what, you're dealing with people who are not unused to these things, and yet this is what happened to them. You know? You know, and it's just like, you know, the ultimate power bro handshake with Carl Weathers there, you know, they built it up. They built it up that these are people who are used to going in and kicking ass in whatever situation they happen to be in. That's their job. That's what they are paid for. That's what they brought in before. They even mention in the beginning when they're like, why are you asking us to do this? We thought you were the best. So they're bringing in the best of the best, and they do a lot of buildup on how good these guys are supposed to be, Dutch and his team. And then to start, watching them go is horrifying. And like I said, the other trope in that is going the other way, that you get these ordinary people who find something in themselves that they never knew they had, you know, to stand up to whatever it is, you know. And that's often used in like the final girl trope in slasher movies. You know, that this high school cheerleader, you know, this, whatever, you know, stands up to this guy, you know, stands up to this slasher or whatever, you know. So that's a good, you know, horror is a good example of how it can kind of go both ways. Although most of the time in RPGs, competency, I mean, I would say 90% of the time, in very few circumstances, you'll start out with, like you said, a little bit. You know, you kind of know where you're going, and you'll start out with a little bit, and then it just kind of builds up as you build the story, because you kind of got to build, you know, you start out with little threats and little things, and then at the end, you're at the big bad, and you're in the big fortress or whatever, you know. So oftentimes, I'd say 90% of the time, that's how it usually works in tabletop. You know, you start out with little stuff, and then build up your reputation, build up your skills until you're ready to take on, you know, the big bad, whatever it happens to be.
And how the mechanics can be set up, because, you know, with some of the people that I was talking to about this as part of my research, some of them brought up some games. Like one of the games that was brought up was Kids on Bikes, where competence, it's not, the game is not necessarily kind of rigged in your favor, so it seems like. I've never played it, never read it, or anything else like that. And so I don't really know for sure, but as I understood how it was explained to me, was that sense of the game's kind of built where you're going to be failing a lot of rules. Things are not always going to be working in your favor. And that actually, you know, rubs some of the people that I spoke to the wrong way. That even if they know they're playing a game where they're dealing with a more powerful force, they still kind of like the impression, at least, that they're going to be able to do some things, you know, versus, you know, kind of screwing up everything, which, you know, right. I'm sure it's kind of like a flavor thing, you know, because as I understand it, you know, people who are very much into horror games really buy into it right away. It's kind of like, totally get it. This is totally the genre. Whereas right. when you
I mean, that's what they expect. Yeah. You know, they want to be scared. They want to be intimidated. And they want to feel that. I mean, that's why you play a horror game. I mean, that's why you sign up for it. You know, if you're not going to be intimidated, if you're not going to be scared, if you're not going to buy into it, then why are you playing a horror game? Go play something where you can be a badass and just go in and dominate everybody. You know, if that's what you want. But people who play horror games, they don't want that. They want to feel small. They want to feel, you know, and I want to say, like, why would somebody want to do that? But oftentimes, at least for me, who loves the horror genre, I write horror fiction. I love horror games. You know, they're some of my favorites and they're my specialty to run. You know, I ran a vampire game and it had probably way more horror than angst than Werewolf would usually have, Call of Cthulhu. I've done Little Fears, which is a very carefully done horror game. Have you played Little Fears?
No, but the title sounds familiar. So I'm just trying to remember.
It won a lot of awards, but it's a very, you have to know the group you're playing. You're playing kids. You're playing kids. And the idea is that kids can see the horrors in the world. They can see the monsters of Slumberland that adults can't. And so you're literally little kids trying to fight these horrors. And just to put it in context, I don't know if I've ever talked about it on the podcast before, but if I have, maybe we can find it or whatever. But for example, you know, an idea in Little Fears is that there are these kings of the land and they all represent the seven deadly sins. And one of them is the king of lust and his realm is a playground. And so when you start having subjects like that in a game, you know, you really have to understand that it really is about that. And for me, it's about two things. Who loves this stuff? I watch horror movies, love them. Horror movies, horror podcasts, horror whatever, just give it to me. I have horror board games deluxe. I love it. And for me, it's for because we play those things because we often feel that way in life. And this is a way that we can confront those things in a safe way and somehow become braver in our real life and get through it. And also to realize that there are things out there bigger than ourselves, you know? So it's both humbling and it's both a way to deal with the fear and helplessness that we often feel in our real life and the horrors that are out there to begin with. And so for that, the competency can't be there because you need to feel those things. But on the other hand, I play the other type of games too. And that's to make you, give you that agency, that competency, to make you feel like you can do those things and you're competent and have badass one-liners and go in and be the one who's intimidating everybody by hearing your name, you know? Yeah. You know, and so it's very different mindsets. And so it's very different starting out, you know, whereas with the other, you might start out with a little bit of competency and build up on that. With horror, you don't do that often, or you do, but it's for a very specific purpose, as we've talked about. You start out with competency just to make you feel, just to drag it out from under you, you know, and bring you back to one, you know.
Yeah. When I think of it, though, is that when I played the Ravenloft campaign setting using the second edition AD&D rules, and I mean, like, we all did for the most part. Like, I remember there being times where we were playing that, and in that one, it's a high fantasy game that goes into a more gothic horror kind of genre. But I remember us as teenagers just like freaking out at these things that were out there trying to kill us and everything like that. And in that case, we're still making the same characters that you would take in a Greyhawk game, in a Dark, well, maybe not a Dark Sun game, but but Forgotten Realms, you know, a lot of the standard fantasy genres, we're still using the same rules to create these characters. But the monsters that we're going up against are clearly built to kill us. Just be like, oh, you're a level 12? That's adorable. I eat level 12 characters for breakfast. Check out my stats. Look at all the ways I could just kill you with one failed saving throw. Woo! You know, kind of thing like that.
Yeah.
And that really offset.
And that's not to say you can't do it in fantasy. You know what I mean? Like, you're giving a good example of, like, you have these characters you built up. You guys are badass in whatever situation you go into. And then all of a sudden you go into this dungeon. And, you know, you're getting wrecked, you know?
Yeah, it's like in that version of Ravenloft, it just said, okay, let's take a werewolf, but let's ramp him up a little bit. You know, where it's like, it's not just a silver weapon, you need a +2 silver weapon. And I'm just spitballing. It has been so long since I've looked at any of that kind of stuff. But, and I think because, you know, the early versions in D&D did very much have this kind of, you know, characters don't just die, they explode, you know, kind of mentality in the build of just like, you know, that the whole idea of a TPK, a total party kill, back in the early days of D&D was a factor. And it worked really well in the Ravenloft game because that really ramped up the horror. You know, I've always loved the idea, it never actually manifested, but I've always loved the idea of starting off a campaign, say, in Forgotten Realms, and then the Mists of Ravenloft come and collect us. And now we, who thought we were the bomb back, you know, like in Faerun, are really quite screwed and in a desperate situation. You know, like any of the resources that we may have had, any of the exploits and legends that we had behind us, mean absolutely nothing in this particular land that has no problem trying to kill us just to make a point. And that's like, you know, off the top of my head, it's an exception I can think of where you take a high level of competency in the characters and then you toy with that by making the things that they fight even tougher, which I think is
reasons. We just talked about that because Ravenloft is a horror. It's the horror realm of D&D.
Hell yeah, it is.
I mean, that's what Ravenloft is. That's what Ravenloft is, you know? So, and we just talked about that, how you take the competent characters and make them feel like they're not. And so no surprise to me that that's Ravenloft, because Ravenloft is the horror setting for D&D that they came up with.
Yeah, and I think it's why it doesn't work as much since... Maybe it would with 3rd edition. I know somebody came up with a 3rd edition version of Ravenloft and everything like that. And for 5th edition, they've come up with some Ravenlofty stuff. But because characters have a greater chance of living, that the game is kind of rigged in the PC's favor nowadays, when the early editions very much seem to be rigged on the GM side, on the DM side. Where it's just like, oh yeah, you can and totally should use this to screw the characters over. And because, like, when last year when I tried to do the Kickstarter for a new version of Campaign Option Mazes, the first thing that I ever made, one of the things that I really wanted to build on this is the idea of it being a horrifying experience, of being lost, being trapped in something where it's just like, well, there's got to be a way out of here. All mazes have a way out. The problem is that it's hidden. You're not supposed to just see it when you walk around the corner. And I wanted to add that level of horror to it. And it just got poo-pooed so much and so frequently. And I can't say that I blame people, honestly, because it takes a lot of work to take the 5th edition of D&D, in my opinion, in order to make it horrific, where you still have that high level of competency, but incredible amount of risk and danger, to the point that now I just want to, I'm more inclined to just kind of make something myself, you know, where, you know, the fantasy heartbreaker route of just like, D&D doesn't do it for me anymore. I'm going to go out and I'm going to make a better version. It's going to be the best thing that's ever out there. That's, you know, I mean, we all do it. It's kind of the curse because one of these days, one of us is going to get it right. But yeah, it's It's really kind of got me thinking, and it's something I really have to consider a lot. Like, especially too, you know, with Killshot, I've got to find this fine line of they're competent and they're capable at doing what they're doing, but that game is a situation of things getting out of hand and out of control in unexpected ways. That's what it's all about. It's about overcoming problems and complications and difficulties and everything like that. And it's a GM-less game, so there has to be ways baked into it that players that could cheat and kind of gloss over stuff and find a way to avoid these kind of problems. But the game, you know, like, is constantly trying to give them these reminders of just like, you know, things don't always go as planned, right? So how are you going to handle this? How are you going to handle this? And that's why it's really kind of got me thinking of just like, I think it's something we take for granted in games that we play, you know, like how competent our characters are. We know it when we don't like it, but we don't necessarily know what it is that we do like. We just don't know when we don't like how it's working out. You know what I mean?
Right. Well, I mean, that's why you can think about, I mean, because Ravenloft would be a good example of looking at, why don't people like Ravenloft? Well, if they don't, or if they do, you know, or if they love it, why do they love it? If they don't, it's because, in my opinion, I would wager to guess, and anybody can weigh in on this who's listening to this, is that if you don't like Ravenloft, it's because you're playing D&D. And the idea of D&D is to go in and kick some ass. So the idea of a setting where you go in and that it's meant to for you not to is going to be frustrating because that's not the game you signed up for. Like, that's not what you signed up to do, right? So that's going to be frustrating. I mean, that would be my guess. I mean, I'm sure there's people out there who loved Ravenloft or saw it as a challenge. You know what I mean? Like it was one of those things where, yeah, we're so badass, we're going to take it on, you know, and we're going to win, you know? I would wager to guess that those would be accurate assumptions to make. Like, either they view it as a challenge if they love it, or they love horror if they love it, and they happen to be playing D&D, or they want to play D&D and they don't like it because they want to play D&D, and Ravenloft doesn't feel as much D&D as the other settings do, you know?
Yeah.
Because it's horror, you know? You know, you're looking Castlevania here, you know, like, you know, so that would be my guess. I mean, can we think of any games where you start out as super, super competent, like not just like a little bit and you have some direction, but like, you know, you're starting out as
like exceedingly competent individuals? No, I can't, you know, off the top of my head,
other than horror, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I'm sure that there are some out there, but I think for the most part, it's because so many games, too, they're always level-based. If they're not, they're more story-based games. And in that, you know, like in story-based games, creating problems in the narrative and overcoming difficulties, things don't, like, Powered by the Apocalypse games being some of the most, you know, definitive of the genre, so to speak. And in that one, that game is very much, you know, kind of rigged to be, there's always going to be some kind of a problem. Like, you know, you still got a good chance of succeeding, but statistically speaking, there's better chance of you having success with a complication than just an outright success. Mm-hmm. And in doing so, you're, you know, doing the failing forward part to things where it's like, you know, even if, you know, things are going to go wrong a lot, but they're not going to go wrong in a way that slows down the story. The story is still going to be able to proceed, you know, and the fun of playing PBTA games for those who love that particular system is the success with the complication, where it's like, I'm still moving forward, but at the same time, too, it's like I'm taking two steps forward, but I also take one step back, and I like that, versus a game that just lets you go one step forward every single time. But as far as like extreme competency, I can't think, the closest I can think of, actually, and this is more of like a homebrew gone awry. One of the things I used to do with the last D&D group that I actually had is we would have a gaming at the lake weekend at my in-laws' cottage. And one of the things that I would do, we were playing 4th edition D&D at the time, and I would run a 20th level one-shot where basically their goal was to kill one of the gods of D&D. I think we did Orcus for the first year, and then I decided to balance it off next year and do Palor, the god of the sun. And so I said, everybody create a 20th level character. Max it out. Go nuts. You know, and basically just throw all the biggest stuff in the game at them. It turned out that it's way better to be a 20th level character than a 20th level monster. They wiped the floor with whatever I threw at them. It got to the point where I just had to start doubling up hit points just to kind of BS my way through it and make it seem like, oh, what a challenging fight, you know? So in that particular case, now, I don't know if that was intended to be like that. You know, when they design it, you get to 20th level, we give up, whatever. You're limitless, you're a divine influence upon the universe, whatever. Just go, play, you know. But yeah, in that one, they were hyper competent. And even for the next year, when I adjusted, they still, you know, like walked the floor with everything I threw at them. That's the closest I can think of. But I kind of feel that that was me misreading the system and what it was supposed to do than how it was built.
Well, actually, now that I'm thinking about it, I do have one that I worked on. Like my very first, I worked on Part-Time Gods with Aloy. And Part-Time Gods, you're literally gods. And the object of the game is not about power. It's about balancing your god life with your human life or everything else, your connections and your followers and things like that. So it's not necessarily you are super competent, but it's about how you balance those things and how you use that. So I suppose that would be an example, you know.
Did you work on the first edition or the second edition on that one?
Second edition.
Okay. Yeah. Because I did the layout. Yeah. And that's, as we've, I think, discussed in here before, that's basically kind of how we met, so to speak.
Yeah.
Like passing by the virtual hallway.
Yeah.
But and I remember in that one, because I've been working with Aloy on getting his new book ready, Outsider's Guide for the second edition. That one's going to be coming up very soon as of the date of this recording. And there's a part in that game where there are truths, and they are things where they're absolute. At no point in time, no matter what the mechanics of the game would say otherwise, this is always going to be true. This always happens. And it's a way of basically, it's like, hey, if you want to make sure that no matter what, so if you are, say, like the god of flashlights, because that's the thing, yeah, that I love about that game is you're the god of like very obscure things. You're not like the great Roman classical gods and stuff like that. It's like, I am the god of the sun, I am the god of the moon, I am all powerful. You're like, I am the god of diesel engines. I don't know why, I just woke up one day and now everything with diesel engines is under my control and my influence.
One time I played the goddess of customer service.
You poor thing. Oh,
I know. I don't know why I did it to myself, but I was the goddess of customer service.
That's the most evil entity that has ever existed in fiction. It was just like, talk about the tormented soul. Can I be the guy who has to push the boulder up the hill for infinity? I'd rather be that, please.
But believe it or not, part of that customer service was being in tune with whatever somebody needed, and I actually used that to greatly my advantage. That was one of my abilities, is to figure out what somebody needed and what somebody wanted so that I could provide it as a service. And that actually worked out. That actually worked out. I was proud of myself. But yes, you're right. You know,
very clever.
I'm pretty sure you can be kind of goddess or god of more bigger things. But you can also god of littler things. I was god of retaliation one time.
Nice.
Yeah.
Ooh, that is a good one. Because, the idea behind that is that is the source or the spark? It's been a little bit since I read it. But the spark, yes. It has diminished over time for unexplained reasons, and as a result, it's been basically passed down to mortals and turning them into gods and that kind of thing. But yeah, like, mechanically, there's a thing in the game called truce. So, like, you know, if I'm playing the god of diesel engines, it could be one of those things where it's just like, you know, any diesel engine starts automatically for me no matter what. So even if you climb into a hunk of junk, as long as it's still got a diesel engine in it and maybe not even a little gasoline, it could be completely bone dry empty. It will still start for you no matter what. You know, it's the god of customer service. You always know what it is that someone's looking for, even if they don't know. Yeah, there we go. Oh, and you have the hardcover too. I was a sucker and I was just like, oh, no, you don't have to get me the hardcover. I'll take a softcover version. And I've regretted it ever since. I want a hardcover version, damn it.
If anybody can't see this, I'm holding the book because I had it next to me on my shelf of stuff I worked on. So the layout that Todd did and my writing is in here.
Together. It's a pretty swanky looking book. I have to admit, I was very proud of that. I still am very proud of that one. Even going through that with the Outsider's Guide and working on the layout, it's just like, damn, this is sharp. I did a good job here. I done good. So, but yeah, no. So in that sense, there is a level of high competency, but at the same time, too, not to the point of, you know, well, certain types of adventures, you're just going to walk all over. You still have to think outside the box. And yeah, when it comes down to it, the entire point of that game is, you know, you could be the god of customer service, but at the same time, too, you're still going to be written up for being late for your shift, you know?
Right. Which I think is worked at a diner. Her domain was this diner and stuff. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah, there are some ways of doing it, but even then, high level, too much competency quickly becomes boring. It's a thing I found a couple of times while playing games using Savage Worlds. It was almost kind of one of those things where it's like, it just seemed like it was working out too well for us. So, you know, and that always kind of leads to a bunch of questions of, you know, did they design this correct, quote unquote? You know, where it's like, oh, did the GM really understand? Like the first time we used Gumshoe, we quote unquote didn't do it right. We tried doing a lot of action-based stuff. We were playing the SO Terrorists, and that's not the style of game that it intends to be.
Right.
That one was on us.
I was just going to say, because it's look at what you're trying to do in the end. What are role-playing games? They're stories, right? And stories aren't any fun to read or to participate in or to play or however you're getting the story via video game or movie or book or RPG, however you're getting your story, if it's easy, right? There's got to be conflict somewhere. There's got to be something that is, you know, an obstacle, or there's got to be something that's more compelling. You know, you can flip this on your head. Right? John Wick did this really, really well, right? So we see this happen, and we don't know who this guy is. We don't know who this guy John Wick is. But then as we get hints, we realize that he does stuff. Like, people are scared of him, you know?
Yeah.
And then we find out why, and that makes it interesting, right? The thing that we don't know is what made that interesting, you know? Because we got to see, you know, and I see a lot of people have said, you know, John Wick is basically a slasher movie from the other end. You know, you're following the slasher going through and killing everybody. And it's interesting because we're rooting for him to do it, right? And we're surprised because we get all this buildup and we know there's a mystery. And then we slowly have it revealed over time. And then the rest of the movie, we're just rooting for him to you know, kill everybody. So, you know, it, you have to play with it, but you have to play with it in a very specific way so that it works out, you know? But anyway, you were talking about Savage Worlds.
Yeah, well, I mean, in that one, and it's been a while since I've read it, let alone played it, but in that one, we were just succeeding a lot. And then at some points, it simply came down to as to whether or not we were going to have, like, a critical success or just a regular success. And when that happens, then it kind of was like, well, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of risk involved. And then you're just kind of going through the motions after a while because there's no threat, you know, really, or it doesn't feel like there's any threat. And now all you're doing is you're just trying to come up with different and unique ways to kill somebody. I think when you bring up the John Wick film, I think we should clarify. We're talking about the John Wick movies. We're not talking about movies. John Wick, the designer, which is you're the only field that has to make too. That clarity.
I know. He had that name first. He had that name first, to be fair.
You know what, though? For all we know, John Wick, the game designer, is actually a well-renowned assassin. And, you know, there are people, he walks around at Gen Con and there are people looking at him in the distance going, Baba Yaga, you know.
Baba Yaga. No, we are actually talking about but Keanu Reeves.
Yeah, there we go. Of course. And, you know, but in the John Wick movies, I think that those movies as is can be better replicated with something like the Savage World system. Because, yeah, it's not about whether or not he fails. It's more so just about how he ends up succeeding. And it's kind of one of these things that you get really with action films. Like, you know, I agree that you could make the metaphor that it's a reverse. It's a slasher movie, but we're rooting for the slasher. I remember always rooting for the slasher in the Friday the 13th movie.
Oh, yeah.
That was the fun of it. He killed a person with a sleeping bag. That's the best one they ever
did. Oh, it's one of the best kills. Yeah, that's one of the best kills.
Beat her to death in a sleeping bag against a tree. Oh, yeah.
Wow.
But from a gaming standpoint, there's a lot of problems for me personally as far as translating the action film genre into a role-playing game is because you watch action films, a lot of them, there is an expectation of success. Anything negative that happens, it's written into the character. It's written into the story, simply just to try and keep it a little bit more suspenseful, to raise the tension a little bit. It's very few action movies are actually shocking and will say, like, kill the main hero. And you're just like, what? You know, and they stay dead. You know, none of this resurrection crap. Or the entire point of the film is then coming back from the dead and kicking ass, you know.
Oh, yeah. And the movie Arnold was in, The Last Action Hero, really made fun of a lot of those tropes.
Yeah, exactly. Because, I mean, really, when it comes down to it, it was one of the things that I really learned when I was working on High Plains Samurai, when I'm trying to replicate a specific genre of action in particular, and I'm trying to find ways to mechanically, you know, reproduce these kind of themes, these kinds of tropes. And it was when I started to realize it's just like, well, how come Tony Jaa can punch this guy out one hit and this guy's down, but this other guy that has a fancier kick, it takes like 5 to 6 punches to bring him down. I don't understand what the difference is between these types of characters. And it's when I realized, well, that happens because someone decided that it happens. The person writing the script just said, you know what? This combatant is going to be tougher to fight. We're going to let this go on for about a minute or so. These other peons, these other 12 people are completely useless. They're just a bunch of goons. We're going to let them fall. It was a creative decision, not, you know, anything about the character and their skills and their competency. The reason why those 12 guys go down so quickly is because the writer said, and they fall down very quickly.
Right.
And it was when I realized that I said, okay, then that's where High Plains Samurai is about determining who gets to decide what happens next. And the mechanics are really more so about determining who's going to set the tone for what the outcome is. Is it going to be the player who made it happen, or is it going to be someone else at the table? And then it's up to them to decide. It's like, that was too easy for you. No, he's still standing. And not only that, he's got giant spikes on a ball on a chain, and he apparently is quite skilled at it. Swing it over his head and he's coming for you. All this kind of stuff. But otherwise, yeah, action, it can be really tricky to replicate in an RPG because action films are about hyper success. There's exceptions like Die Hard and stuff, you know, like.
Well, that's what made Die Hard really refreshing at the time, was because,
yes,
you know, Bruce Willis got beat up and it was different and than what people had seen previously from like Arnold and Stallone and stuff, you know, in the action movies they'd been in. So that's what made it different. That's why Die Hard is Die Hard and people know Die Hard because, you know, Bruce Willis is walking around barefoot with bleeding feet and a wife beater and beat all the hell, you know.
I remember in the theaters watching Lethal Weapon 4, and I know I'm bringing up a Mel Gibson movie, but there is, it's the first, as I understand it, it's the first North American film that Jet Li was ever in, and that's basically what, you know, kind of, you know, brought his popularity over here. I remember watching that. Jet Li's character is far more competent than Riggs and Murtaugh are. Riggs and Murtaugh are kind of blindly at times kind of stumbling their way through stuff and everything like that. And I remember when it came down to the final fight scene between the three characters, I literally thought one of the Riggs or Murtaugh was going to get killed. Bar none, enough said. And I remember it being in the theaters because I, you know, I was a huge fan of those movies growing up. Not as much anymore as I gotten older, but at the time I was a huge fan. And I thought, holy crap, this Jet Li guy is going to kill them. And I just remember that kind of adrenaline rush of actually thinking that these characters are in over their head for the first time in an 80s, 90s style action movie. That's how much of a rarity it really was to effectively invoke that emotion. And yeah, and that was just because it just seemed like, and sure enough, it was like, you know, a really dragged out brawl of, you know, someone, you know, like it's, you know, Riggs almost did die in the fight and everything else like this. It got really bloody. It got pretty gruesome with that level of intensity to it and everything like that. But otherwise, it's, I find hard to recreate in an RPG unless the entire point is to say it's like, oh yeah, you'll be fine. Cuts and bruises. We're not even going to bother with hit points because why? What am I going to do? Kill you? Yeah. I don't think so. That's not what we're here for. We're here to measure the body count, not how much blood you lose.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. So I think, I mean, if I'm sounding like our conversation, it's kind of all about, like you said, expectation. What is your expectation? Yeah. And I think what I've come to talking about this is that the expectation has a lot to do with the genre. A lot to do with the genre that you're about to play. Are you playing horror? Are you playing fantasy? Are you playing action? Are you playing urban fantasy? What are you playing? And therefore, the competency level is different depending on what you're going to play. And if you start messing with those competency levels, you have to do it in a very careful way or people are going to be dissatisfied because they didn't step into the game to play that type of competency. That's not their competency expectation for their character or the game. And so if you start playing with that, they can get mad unless you try to subvert it somehow in a way that they can handle or a way that people have agreed to. You know what I mean? You know, I mean, this is going to be ridiculous, but like Inspector Gadget did that. Like, Inspector Gadget. You expect the hero Inspector Gadget to be competent. And he was not. at all in the cartoon. His little niece and the dog were doing everything, you know? So, but because it did, it was funny. It was supposed to be funny because it was subverting that expectation that he was going to be this super competent guy. And usually if they aren't, and we expect them to be, it's usually comedy. You know what I mean? If it's a genre that we expect competency and they're not, it's usually for comedy or it's usually funny.
Yeah. It's done intentionally. And even too, like an Inspector Gadget game, I think would be better played if you're Penny and Brain
rather than being Inspector Gadget. Your job is to keep him out of trouble. Yeah. Right. Your job is to keep him out of trouble. Your obstacles are like trying to stop him from dying or doing stuff or messing up, you know,
while still making him look like he's the one who saved the day. What? Like you're acting in anonymity.
We could make it. Yep. We could make it, Todd. We could. There's this game yep. where everybody in the group is playing like the sidekicks or minions of the hero who is actually incompetent. And our job is to make sure that he's... This could be a game. We could do this. I'm serious. That could be a yep. game. We could do it. It'd be funny as hell.
Where it's like the person you're trying to help is causing all the different problems.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that you constantly have to overcome, and yeah. you still need to make them look like $1 million in the process.
Right. Yep.
Yep. Yeah. That'd be fun. You know what? Let's keep that on a back burner if we're ever looking to do, you know, to make something that's not of the scale of Ironbound. You know, something just yes. like, let's make a small game together, you know?
Yeah. Indeed. Indeed.
Yeah.
For sure.
Cool, cool, cool.
Well, is there anything, because we have once again... but is there any other last brief thoughts or wrap up or anything you wanted to mention
no.
before we say goodbye?
No, I think we got it covered there. Like I said, I thought it was one of those things that was really good to talk about because there's a bunch of other things coming up. So like, I think this is a good, really good kind of lead into the horror episode that we've talked about.
Woo! Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we've kind of established this kind of level of just like, nah, you're supposed to die. You know, it's like, approaching that from a game standpoint or just like a fiction standpoint, everything else like that. But we also, we actually got like a listener request for an episode. Phil Watson, one of our backers, wants to hear us talk about social combat, his words.
It's
a term I like to look at as being social conflict. And then that's an issue that I think...
I'm excited about that. Yeah. I love that. I have lots of good stories about that sort of thing.
yeah, okay, cool. Yeah, because for that, I find the character's competency when it comes to social-based aspect, it kind of needs to go in the opposite direction. In that sense of just like, it's better and it's more interesting... when you're not, you know, always the guaranteed smooth talker. You always have a way with people, you know, you can get away with things. It's more fun when people kind of stumble over their own words, accidentally say the wrong thing.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of stuff. So, yeah that's why I thought about establishing this benchmark was a good way to kind of start before we get into some of our other topics.
Yeah, and with that sort of thing, there's also this aspect of player competency. And how good is the player at being witty? And, you know, and how do you handle it when their character is wittier than them or not as witty as them? And how do you balance those things out in a way? You know, someone's shy, but they want to play a character who can talk their way out of it. But they themselves are going to have a hard time for whatever reason. Then how do you do that? You know, like that. That's all sorts of good stuff about how to run those things so everybody's satisfied.
Yeah.
And you get,
When it gets to system mastery of a game, right. I think that's a really good one we can get into as well. Because, you know, like it's, some people kind of look at that as cheating. You know, it's like, you know the game better than I do. But it is one of those things where, yeah, there's definitely a way where system mastery can make a huge difference in how you approach games and everything else like that. Yeah. So yeah. See, there we go. We've got like 4 or 5 other topics that we can divulge from this.
That's but for I know next you've time. Been wanting like to talk about another episode. Yes. Now we're getting into like another episode.
Yeah. Yeah. I think talking about horror as a genre next time, I think would be kind of really cool to get into. Kind of like a segue lead in from the and exactly yeah I know you've been wanting to do that start doing our genre mini series for a little while, so yeah, cool. I think we're good.
Yeah, I mean, maybe we can put in a little horror music zing at the beginning. It'd be awesome.
Yes. Bum-bum. I shall work on, you know what, we'll add like thunder and lightning and I mean, I don't know if this would be appropriate, but I can't help but feel like, would it be cool to add like a traditional Halloween witch's cackle at the beginning? Or is that like pushing the boundaries?
I can provide it. I can provide the cackle if we want a cackle.
Okay.
I can provide a cackle.
Done. There we go. This way we know for a fact it's an actual witch's cackle.
It is an actual witch's cackle.
Here's a little segue, and if I'm totally, just a quick little segue, and if I'm totally in the wrong, we will cut this out, because I do not want to give off the impression that I'm being an insensitive dick about this. I have for a while, particularly in the Facebook, wanting to do something to the effect of, what's up, witches? Is that pushing it, or is that something that's not cool for me to say, or, you know, what's your impression on that?
You know, me personally, I don't care, but, like, I can imagine some might. I don't know. Okay, gotcha. I think it's one of those things that, like, I personally don't care. I think it was funny. What up, witches? Especially since we got, like, a witch podcast. But, I mean, some people might. Yeah. I mean, I can't guarantee that everybody will be like, ha-ha, you know? So, but for me, I personally, as well as I can speak for myself, say it doesn't bother me, but it might some. So I guess be ready for that. All right. If you do.
Okay. I'll keep this in, and we'll kind of throw this out there and just be like, you know, hey, if this is actually, you know, and okay, I can totally get, especially to the whole idea is that witches replaces the word bitches. That is, you know,
oh, that's definitely, you know, like pushing some boundaries. Like yeah. And like,
oh,
yeah.
Well, in that case, then if a bumper sticker's done it, I guess it's cool.
Yeah, I mean, witches do it all the time. So, yeah, I mean, that's a thing I've seen. And that, so.
Yes, but I'm not a witch. And so that, you know, like I said, that could just
like
be kind
of one of
those. Like
I said, it doesn't bother me. Okay. But, you know, it may some others suggest to be aware of that, you know.
Okay.
I mean, maybe to get away with it, find a meme and post that instead. Then it's not really.
Yeah. It's not me. I'm just sharing a joke. I'm just a messenger. Yep. All right. Well, you know what, listeners? Let us know. Let me know, I guess. What do you think? Cool or not cool? And, you know.
Anyway, oh, yeah. Until next time, people, we hope you have a little gaming in your magic and a little magic in your gaming. Until next time.
The Covenstead Podcast was created and produced by Danielle Delisle and Todd Crapper. Theme music written and composed by John Thompson from the Rook and Rask channel on Twitch. Definitely check them out.
Special thanks to all of our backers: Alex, Tim Brannan, Chris Atrata, Century Guild, Nicholas Diak, Fool's Moon Entertainment, Kaboom.com, minus five O's, no apologies, Brian P. Kurtz, Jason LaDuke, Civ Light, Revna, Derek Simsek, Danielle Thomas, Phil Watson, Jacob Wood, and Victor Wyatt.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.